Is at stake. Well, the Pentagon and related agencies like nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy, the war budget, which is a huge slush fund for the Pentagon, you put that together, you're already over $600 billion a year. And then if you look at related things like Veterans Affairs, Homeland Security, military aid, the military-related interest on the debt, you push up more towards $1 trillion. And part of the problem we have is these sums are so huge that people have no way to get their arms around them.
The Breaking Through Power mobilization brings hundreds of activists, scholars, and writers to the DMV. Also, journalist E.R. Shipp joins us to talk about the latest in the Freddie Gray case. And Kimon Freeman joins us to talk about the Nose Displacement Zone movement in Wards 7 and 8 of the district. All that and more coming up. Good morning, DMV. Welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on 89.3 WPFW, your listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam here on our third and final day for us for the spring membership drive. We've made our goal so far this drive in our new time slot on Fridays. So I hope our listeners from Thursday morning have found us and know where we are again. So I'm making an appeal to all of our listeners to become new or renewing members or to make a contribution to someone else. Maybe it's Father's Day coming up. We just had Mother's Day. You know, a new graduate. Turn them on to this Jazz and Justice listener powered public radio station. And, you know, the number 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or pledge right online at WPFW.org. There's a big red donate now button that you can click on and it gives you all the instructions to give. Well, today's voices of resistance come from the major Breaking Through Power mobilization that ended yesterday here in D.C. Over 4 days, hundreds of activists gathered at Constitution Hall and thousands more tuned into the live stream to hear people who are actively working to make a difference speak on how they are breaking through power, especially in media, in the war industry, and in our bought and paid for Congress. We're actually going to hear some of what went on at Breaking Through Power, and in the second half, we'll hear about an upcoming community and political forum for Wards 7 and 8 here in the district that residents are declaring to be a no-displacement zone against gentrification. So, as always, we have a jam-packed show, starting with this week's headlines. Veteran consumer and civic engagement advocate Ralph Nader sponsored the Breaking Through Power gathering this week, which brought together an array of those working for social justice, including Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, journalist Chris Hedges and John Nichols, and several high-profile whistleblowers, including William Binney and John Kiriakou. Chantel James covered some of the program yesterday and filed this report.
More than 200 activists gathered at Constitution Hall in downtown Washington for a summit called Breaking Through Power. The summit spanned 4 days, inspired by the 50th anniversary of Ralph Nader's groundbreaking book, Unsafe at Any Speed. Nader hosted as more than 50 speakers held forth on topics as diverse as U.S. foreign policy, corporate crime, and the minimum wage. University of Massachusetts Amherst professor Robert Poland spoke of the widely endorsed minimum income policy.
We're very close to doing something that was inconceivable 3 years ago, which was the doubling the national minimum wage, $15 minimum wage. And if we're talking today about fighting for in power in Congress, let's fight and win the fight for a $15 minimum wage. And win that fight, consolidate that, raise living standards, reduce inequality, and then we can talk about what we do about a minimum income beyond that.
This is Chantel James for On the Ground, signing off.
Now, the Fight for 15 took to the streets yesterday as McDonald's held its annual meeting outside Chicago in Oak Brook, Illinois. Fast food workers confronted the burger giant and asked again for a decent wage and union rights. In addition to those working in fast food in the U.S. and abroad, other underpaid workers, including those in the childcare and airport sectors, also took part in the protests. A national strike is going on in France amid intensifying clashes with police, protests against President François Hollande's controversial set of labor reforms deepened yesterday as workers in France's nuclear plants joined hundreds of thousands of people taking part in a nationwide action. Fueled by groundswell of public anger, as the Associated Press put it, the strikes have already shut down France's gas stations, forced the country to dip into reserve petrol supplies. After oil refinery shutdowns, Euronews reports, Thursday's strikes at nuclear sites have taken the standoff one stage further. Power cuts are not expected, but tension is growing as France prepares to hold the Euro 2016 football tournament in 2 weeks' time. 16 out of the country's 19 nuclear plants voted to join the strike, AP reports. In addition to clashes in Paris, where police fired tear gas at demonstrators, The Guardian reports that street marches took place in towns and cities across France, including Toulouse, Bordeaux, and Nantes. Scores of people were arrested. In Brazil, suspicions have been confirmed that the ouster of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff is in fact a coup designed to eradicate a wide corruption probe. Brazil's largest newspaper on Monday published evidence of a national pact between a top government official and an oil executive. The newspaper published transcripts of a 75-minute phone conversation between the newly installed planning minister Romero Juca, a senator at the time, and former oil executive Sergio Machado. But the discussion reportedly took place in March, just weeks before Brazil's lower house voted to impeach the democratically elected Rousseff. Both Juca and Machado were targets of an ongoing internal investigation known as Operation Car Wash, which sought to expose money laundering and corruption at the state-controlled oil company Petrobras, which allegedly accepted bribes in exchange for contracts. The transcripts, according to Intercept reporting, reveals explicit plotting between the two men, who agree that removing Dilma is the only means for ending the corruption investigation. This week's Black Lives Matter news comes from Baltimore, where police officer Edward Nero was acquitted of all charges in the death of unarmed African-American Freddie Gray in police custody last April. Now, with me to discuss the acquittal and the latest in the Freddie Gray case is veteran journalist E.R. Shipp, professor of journalism at Morgan State University, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and now a contributing columnist for the Baltimore Sun. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
So glad you can be with us today.
Great. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So apparently this case against Edward Nero was the weakest case that the prosecution had, but a lot of us, you know, who are just looking on the case as outsiders wonder why it was so weak. You know, those of us who saw the video saw that two police officers arrested Freddie Gray. He seemed to be kind of knotted into a pretzel, some witnesses said. He seemed to be injured before he already got into the van. And that's what a lot of people are talking about. So explain, you know, help us understand why the case against Nero was so weak and why you think the acquittal happened.
Well, this was a bench trial, which means that a judge decided the decision, the case. And he looked at facts, and often what we, the people, look at, we approach more viscerally and emotionally. He did not do that. So that's one reason for a distinction in what he looked at and what we thought we saw. The questions that were litigated in the trial concern the procedures used. First of all, whether there was a reason to confront and then arrest or attempt to arrest Freddie Gray, but also who put him in the police van, whose responsibility it was to apply the seat belts. Those are the kinds of things that came up in this particular case, not whether Freddie Gray was injured before or to what extent. They were looking at whether there was a reason to confront him in the first place, and then they looked at what happened in getting him into the police van. This particular officer was one of the two who pursued Freddie Gray after making eye contact, apparently. He had minimal responsibility, it seems, for actually placing him in the van. And that's a large part of what the judge focused on in determining that the prosecutor really hadn't proved her case.
Okay, so there isn't, the court isn't looking at the arrest procedure, the way he was, the whole knee in the back at the spine, which is what a lot of people were talking about initially.
That wasn't the issue in this trial. Now, remember, there are five more to come, and the other five presumably are more culpable. In fact, in this particular trial, one officer did testify. And that particular officer was the second officer involved in apprehending Freddie Gray. He was called by the prosecutor, but he pretty much gave testimony that helped the defense, helped his fellow brother in blue. And he pretty much said that he had more responsibility than Nero did for apprehending and placing Freddie Gray in the van. So the questions will come up then when his trial comes up, how much of this can be used. The officers who are testifying are doing so with a certain degree of immunity, which means that they can't, some of the stuff that they testify to against their fellow officers cannot be used against them necessarily. But the prosecutor may have come up with some of this information from other sources and may be able to question him more thoroughly about his own role. I mean, Officer Miller in this case. So we still have more trials to come. And if Nero's was the weakest, one can only hope that the others are going to be much stronger.
I do know that the next trial is actually of the officer who drove the van.
And everybody's trying to literally throw him under the bus by saying that the driver of the van had ultimate responsibility for assuring that the seat belts were properly used and to also check on the condition of Freddie Gray while he was being transported. So Officer Goodson's trial is scheduled to come up next, and we will see what the case is against him. But he is the only one charged with murder in the case.
Right. Okay. All right. So I'm thinking about other ongoing impacts. There was for a while seemingly a work slowdown. There was a crime wave in Baltimore last year. And how is that playing out? Is there still a sense that police officers are kind of taking a more hands-off approach to their jobs?
That's hard to gauge. I noticed in the paper today that we've hit the 100 mark in the terms of homicides in Baltimore. That is lower than last year at the same time, but a bit higher than previous years. So we're trying to figure out whether there's a pattern that started last April, whether that's attributable to factors such as last year, they were saying that a lot of the homicides revolved around rivalries between drug gangs that emerged after the riots when a lot of drugs were stolen from pharmacies, for example. So there was a lot more of certain kinds of drugs on the market and there were some rivalries. That's part of the police explanation. In addition to what seemed to be a work stoppage, it's unclear whether any of that is going on now, but I do know that the police are still very much unhappy with Marilyn Mosby, the prosecutor, and very much unhappy with some of the reforms that the commissioner is trying to put into place. Now, two of the officers who are charged with contributing to the death of Freddie Gray have actually brought a civil lawsuit against the prosecutor.
Right, tell us about that.
Quite unusual.
Yeah, tell us about that. I mean, it seems like anyone who was charged with a crime can claim defamation, but...
Yeah, that's what they're claiming, defamation and invasion of privacy. It seems to be many lawyers who've been quoted in trying to analyze what's going on with these officers have been fairly dismissive of the case. But the officers claim that they didn't want the lawsuit to be made public until after their trials. But they claim also they had to file their claims because of statutes of limitations. It still seems to me a bit frivolous. I'm not quite sure what they're trying to do other than maybe to sort of shore up their support among their fellow officers and to further cast doubts on the abilities and the motivations of Marilyn Mosby, the prosecutor.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist E.R. Shipp, professor at Morgan State University, who now contributes a column to the Baltimore Sun. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Now, finally, in our culture and media moment, there was a momentous day here at WPFW last weekend when Andrea Bray, our queen of rhythm and blues, retired after serving as anchor of old school music here at the station. Andrea Bray, we salute you. We will miss you, and we salute you from the news and public affairs section of the grid. And as many of your fans who called in Saturday, you will be greatly missed. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, you won't believe how your hard-earned money, your tax dollars, are being taken from you to fund the military-industrial complex. Stay with us, and in the meantime, call 202-588-9739 or pledge online at wpfwfm.org. Before I go, though, I want to thank someone, and I want to thank her so you can join her. I want to thank Hazel. Thank Hazel from Northeast DC for being a new member. Can I get the bell? Yes. Thank you, Mike. So thank you, Hazel. A wonderful activist in Northeast DC trying to do so many things in the community in Ward 5. Thank you so much for reaching out and supporting on the ground. You can join Hazel because I know you do appreciate coverage of activists and activism here in the DMV and wherever we go, around the country, around the world. 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or go online to wpfwfm.org. Don't let me down. It's our last week to raise money. We want to meet our goal to support justice programming here at the station. 202-588-9739. Stay with us.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
Talking about love, man, brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to my nation.
That was Ball of Confusion by The Temptations this morning on the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. Again, playing that in honor of Andrea Bray, who retired after many years here at WPFW last Saturday and did her last Rhythm and Blues show. I'm Esther Avera. I'm here on the third and final day for us for the Spring Membership Drive, making an appeal to all of those listening to become new or renewing members of this listener-powered station. I think we've heard from people from D.C. during the drive, Virginia. I need to hear some more people from Maryland. I know we got a call from Annapolis, I think from Lauren last week. I thank her again. So we need you to join those who have called already to be new members of the station or renewing members. Only $10 a month. Think about that. Think about like what you spend $10 on. You can't even go to a movie for $10 most of the time. So, you know, this is for your media. This is so that we can have the voices that you don't hear anywhere else. You know, not that my voice is all that special. I'm talking about the guests that we bring in, the alternative perspectives, your voice, you know, even when we do the call-ins, the fact that you have a place that you can be heard over 50,000 watts from the DMV to DC, Maryland, Virginia, west parts of West Virginia and Delaware. And this is such a critical time in this country politically. We have someone running for president. We have more than one person running for president who are talking about war, talking about banning Muslims, talking about, you know, building walls to separate us. And we have a media here that's about keeping us together, joining us together, joining all justice-minded people together. And, you know, we have something that's very precious. And I know you appreciate that. And I know that you want to appreciate the justice programming, because, you know, you might wake up one day. I don't mean to be a scary cat, but you may wake up one morning and it's not here because we didn't rally around and support it. 202-588-9739 is the call. This is my last week to try to make our goal. We've made our goal so far. I want to go out with a bang. So the Breaking Through Power mobilization was held here in DC this week, and the piece that I'm going to play for you, it focuses on war. The organizer of the conference, Ralph Nader, said that this particular day was dedicated to enhancing the waging of peace over the waging of war, the horrors of war, its huge costs here and abroad to innocence, and the weakening blowbacks of empire amidst a collapse of constitutional and international law. Of all the hours I listened to the truly brilliant analysis I heard this week, I chose this extended clip featuring two activists fighting the military-industrial complex, William Hartung and Daniel Bryan. Here they are being introduced and then speaking at Breaking Through Power. Call 202-588-9739.
So we're going to move on to our next two panelists, William Hartung. There is likely no more knowledgeable speaker anywhere on the issue of arms sales, weapons, and how the weapons industry drives our wars than William Hartung. He is the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. He was the co-author of Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War. Mr. Hartung was the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New American Foundation. And prior to that, he was the director of the Arms Trade Resource Center, a world policy institute. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post. He's a national security expert, has appeared on CBS 60 Minutes, CNN, NewsHour, and many, many other media outlets. Joining him will be Danielle Bryan. She is the executive director of Project for Government Oversight, which works to expose overspending by government agencies, which sounds to me like a full-time job. She frequently testifies before Congress and meets with members of the White House staff and others to find ways to make government more accountable, open, and ethical. Ms. Bryan was also appointed to the Secretary of the Interior to serve on the U.S. Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative Federal Advisory Committee. I'm not making this up. I don't know what that is, but I hope she'll tell us. Ms. Bryan serves on the Board of Taxpayers for Common Sense and is chair of the Steering Committee for OpenTheGovernment.org. Their topic is going to be defective defense. Please welcome William Hartung and Danielle Bryan.
I want to thank you all for being here. Thank RAL, Veterans for Peace, all the organizers. It's an honor to be on the panel with Danielle and to come after all the great speakers that we've had today. I've been talking about this issue for a long time. And what I used to do is I would paint a very bleak picture of the powerful behemoth that is the military-industrial complex. And then people would come up to me and say, God, it really is hopeless, Bill. I'm going home. So I'm going to shorten that part. And to say that we can make a difference, we have made a difference. We've been working in smaller numbers in recent years, but I think people should take credit for the fact that we've stuck with it, we've kept these issues alive, and I think we're entering a period where there'll be an upsurge of activism on our issues and where we'll make greater victories. Not that it won't be bumpy along the way. So our panel's defective defense, and I guess the question is, why is it defective? Who benefits from it being defective? And how much money is at stake? And I think you'll find, if you read some of the publications of the organizations that spoke prior, a lot of the money that's spent on the Pentagon has nothing to do with defending anybody, and a lot of it, were it ever used, would end life as we know it. So how much money is at stake? Well, the Pentagon and related agencies, like nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy, the war budget, which is a huge slush fund for the Pentagon, you put that together, you're already over $600 billion a year. Then if you look at related things like Veterans Affairs, Homeland Security, military aid, the military-related interest on the debt, you push up more towards $1 trillion. And part of the problem we have is these sums are so huge that people have no way to get their arms around them. So one way to look at it, among others, is if you waited for 1 million seconds to do something, that would be 12 days. If you waited 1 billion seconds, it would be 31 years. And if you waited 1 trillion seconds, it would be 31,000 years. So I wouldn't wait if I were you. You know, other ways of looking at it, Ron Klain, who was President Obama's ombudsman to deal with the Ebola crisis, had a piece in the Washington Post talking about the obscene debate in Congress over whether we have enough money to address the Zika virus, acting as if somehow we don't. And he pointed out that the amount they were arguing over is about 7 days' worth of Pentagon spending. So, you know, the money is there. We just have to put it in the right place. Another way to look at it is the Department of State, which should be our lead agency in the international arena, gets only 1/12 as much money as the Pentagon. And that's before you add all those other related activities. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates pointed out there are more personnel in an aircraft carrier task force, of which the United States has 11, than there are trained diplomats in the entire U.S. State Department. So that gives you some sense of how tilted the priorities are. Now, there's many reasons given for this, but one of the sort of arguments of last resort is always jobs. You know, sure, we'd love to change these policies, but there's millions of jobs at stake, and therefore we can't do it. You know, first off, I would say if we took that approach to everything, nothing would ever change, literally. And we certainly can't afford to do it in this area. But the other thing that the people who use this argument don't want people to know is that Pentagon spending is the worst possible way to create jobs. If you invested in infrastructure, you know, say like a DC metro that worked, if you invested in alternative energy, which we desperately need, any money going into any of these other areas would create 1.5 times as many jobs as spending on weapon systems. And if we had the leadership to do that and the training for those people who are building weapons to move into other areas, that problem could be solved. But of course, it's going to be a big fight, but I think it's a fight that has to be had. So I think of the Pentagon budget as a job killer, not a job creator, because it's sucking money from things that would create many more jobs. Now, of course, we talked about the role of Congress, and people mentioned the military-industrial congressional complex. And I was watching the debate on the House floor the other day of the National Defense Authorization Act, which is not a popular hobby, I have to say, based on my informal surveys. I was watching it, and suddenly amendment after amendment to do these ridiculous things kept coming up. And I said, what is up with this? So I started Googling each member who had a ridiculous idea to figure out whether the issue they were talking about related to a company in their state or district. And after 3 in a row, I sort of stopped because it was clear this was almost the rule when it came to spending on weapon systems, that it was all about money in the district for companies that have jobs there that provide contributions to the member and so forth. So one particularly egregious one, there was a member from Arkansas who wanted to take money from a good program, a program that is used to lock down nuclear materials and bomb-making materials so they can't get in the hands of terrorists or other people who might use them. Now, of course, nobody should have nuclear weapons in their hands. We understand that. But we certainly don't want them to spread further to groups that might use them in a terrorist attack. So this program is designed to prevent that from happening, as opposed to waiting to see what happens and then saying we need more money for Star Wars, which is what this money was going to a missile defense program built in Camden, Arkansas, which was in this member's district. So he was able to take money from a useful program that might prevent the use of nuclear weapons, put it in a useless, overfunded missile defense program, and get away with it. And this kind of thing happens all the time. There's a little wrinkle in this year's budget debate, which, if it seems arcane, it's because it is, and it's because they're trying to keep us from understanding how they're using our money. But for years now, they've taken the war budget, which is not subject to budget caps, and they've thrown everything in the kitchen sink in there that the Pentagon or some member wants. So it's a slush fund for their pet projects. It has nothing to do with supplying the troops on the front lines. So this year, Mac Thornberry, who's awash in Pentagon contracts in his state and heads of the House Armed Services Committee, said, well, you know, let's borrow, say, $18 billion from this war fund and spend it on F-35s, which are built in Texas, F-18s, which are built in Missouri, a whole laundry list of projects. And this was beyond what the Pentagon even asked for. And then he said, well, and then, you know, if we run out of money for the troops, let the next president worry about it, you know. And this is the same guy who was saying, we're not taking care of our troops, they can't be trained, they're looking for spare parts in museums. And, of course, he's taking billions and billions of dollars that could be used for those purposes to spend on weapons that the Pentagon hasn't even asked for. So there's sort of a small fraud and the bigger fraud, but it's all, in many cases, about taking care of the military-industrial congressional complex in one form or another. And these companies cash in to an obscene degree. I did a book about Lockheed Martin, which is the world's largest military contractor. And they get $30 to $40 billion in Pentagon contracts in a, what for them is a good year, and for us, obviously, is a bad year. And, you know, that's more than most federal agencies get. It's more than the operating part of the State Department's budget. And then if you look at some of the big programs, like the F-35 combat aircraft, that's supposed to cost $1.4 trillion over its lifetime. There goes that trillion again. It seems to be kind of a natural number for the Pentagon. And so that amount of money, the $1.4 trillion, would make it the 13th largest economy in the world, just ahead of Spain. Now, I don't know if you'd want to live in a country that was entirely made up of F-35s, but it's just another sense of how much money is being wasted in this regard. And I think, you know, maybe biggest of all, and this has been mentioned several times and can't be mentioned enough, there's a plan to spend $1 trillion on new nuclear bombers, new nuclear weapons armed submarines, new intercontinental ballistic missiles, additional money for the whole nuclear warhead complex, which is run by the Department of Energy. None of that money needs to be spent. And I think, as was mentioned, it would be very fitting if the president were to come back from Hiroshima and put a hold on those programs. And, of course, he's not going to do that without a lot of pressure. But I think it's well worth demanding. So that's a little bit of the inner workings of the military-industrial complex. But I wanted to talk about how, even under quite difficult circumstances, we've been able to win some victories. And I expect there to be more to come as we involve more people in these efforts. A couple years ago, the Pentagon decided it wanted to stop buying the F-22 combat aircraft, which cost about $200 million a pop at minimum, and was not clear what they would ever use it for. Lockheed Martin said, oh, no, we need another 100 of these. The Air Force said, oh, no, we need another 100 of these. And it was just assumed if you teamed up Lockheed Martin and the Air Force, it was case closed. They were going to get their planes. But a coalition came together, including groups like POGO. I worked a bit on it, Women's Action for New Directions, Peace Action, and others. And in this case, even the president was against building this thing. And when it came, when push came to shove, Lockheed Martin lost that vote in the Senate, despite the fact that they used the jobs argument, despite the fact that they spread all their money around for lobbying, despite the fact that they give campaign contributions. It was such a bad idea that even they couldn't get away with it. And more recently, and this is probably not well known, but you know, as I mentioned before, there are caps on the Pentagon budget, going back to the Budget Control Act of a few years ago. And they've got all kinds of ways to try to get around it. But nonetheless, because of those caps, they've probably gotten a couple hundred billion dollars less than they expected to get. And also, if it weren't for the efforts of some of the people in this room, they would have put caps on the domestic budget and let the Pentagon go scot-free. So a number of us were part of that effort to cap the Pentagon budget. And there was pushback from the industry, and once again, the job argument reared its head. And the Aerospace Industries Association sponsored a bogus study, which was basically 5 pages of assertions, that said that we'd lose 1 million jobs if the budget caps stayed in place. So they stayed in place. They did some finagling, but in essence, they stayed in place. Employment increased. We need better jobs. There's no question about it. But those 1 million jobs did not disappear. And it got to the point where even some of the members of Congress said, you know, I don't believe these guys anymore. Get out of my office, which is a pretty amazing thing in the history of congressional weapons contractor relations. And then, of course, we had the Iran deal, which the industry was sort of more in the background on that. It was more of an issue of groups like AIPAC, of Netanyahu coming to speak to Congress, of a whole ideology of demonization, which feeds back into, of course, the arguments for why we need to spend more on the Pentagon. So, you know, I think what we need to do is, there's sort of two pieces of it. You know, some people say, well, you know, the peace movement disappeared. I don't see it that way. I think those of us who stuck with it have done an important service and should be proud of what we've done, because I think we kept these issues alive for the moment when they can take off again, where we can build a bigger coalition and we can make a bigger difference. And sometimes the people who fight in the trenches when the odds are the worst are the ones who deserve the most credit. And I'm not speaking about myself, but many people in the audience here. And we have to strengthen our base as well as reach out. So groups like FCNL and Women's Action for New Directions and Peace Action and Code Pink and Veterans for Peace need our support in whatever way possible. Is it money? Is it our time? Is it, as Jim Kaysen said earlier, spreading these messages to people we don't normally talk to, don't normally agree with, to change the conversation? I think there's a lot we can do to get that ripple effect moving again. And I think when we do that, all that concentrated power in the hands of these companies is not going to be enough to stop us. And that's certainly why I do this, and I believe that. Otherwise, I'd be, you know, on a sailboat in the Bahamas or something like that, except I can't afford it. So anyway, that's what I had to say for now. And Danielle and I may kick some of these issues around later.
If you're just tuning in, you just heard voices from the third day of the Breaking Through Power mobilization here in D.C. This particular day was focused on war. You heard William Hartung, and he was on the panel with Daniel Bryan, who we'll hear after the break. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital on 89.3. This is WPFW, Pacifica Radio in the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam, and I have another person to thank. We are in the midst of our spring membership drive, and I also want to thank Michelle Roberts, our environmental justice guru, the scientist, tremendous activist, and she is challenging the environmental justice and climate justice communities to come and pledge to become new and renewing members of the station to support On the Ground this morning. And she's made a very generous pledge. She's becoming a sustainer. And So she would like everyone else to become sustainers as well. And so would I. 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or 1-800-222-9739, or WPFWFM.org. So we're going to go to a brief break, and then we'll come right back.
Let me tell you about a place somewhere up in New York way, where the people are so gay, twisting the night away. Here they have a lot of fun, putting trouble on the run. Man, you find the old and young twisting the night away. They're twisting, twisting. Everybody's feeling great. They're twisting, twisting. They're twisting the night away. About you. Stay away too long and I can't do without you. Every chance you get you seem to hurt me more and more. But each hurt makes my love stronger than before. I know flowers grow to rain, but how can love go to pain?
Welcome back to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio. Over the break, that was our second tribute to Andrea Bray, just retired on Saturday as our queen of rhythm and blues here at WPFW. Thank to Floyd, DJ Waheed, Aaron for that mix. I'm Esther Verm, and we are going to actually shift gears, running out of time today, and we are going to post that second piece of audio from Breaking Through Power on our website, onthegroundshow.org. But right now we're going to switch to Kimmon Freeman, activist, poet, radio entrepreneur, all those good things. And he's going to talk to us about an important event that's happening next week in Ward 7 and 8. Good morning, Kimmon.
Peace and blessing.
So tell me about this economic forum on Tuesday, what it'll be, tell the audience what it's about.
Well, I urge everyone to check out the movie V for Vendetta if they haven't seen it. It's a wonderful film that really kind of like describes the type of consumer uprising that's necessary for us to put a leash on gentrification and runaway capitalism in our society as it applies to everyday life, from bridges collapsing to our sick care system and what have you. We want to make sure that's fair because the reason I bring that up.
You said
November,
V for Vendetta, right?
Yes,
the Wachowski brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the lines from that film, it says, always remember the 5th of November. And the reason I bring that up is because November 5th of 2015, the City First Foundation Community Development Conference held an event that really brought a lot of developers and businesses together. It was held at the Rise Demonstration Center. That's part of the Gateway Pavilion for St. Elizabeth Development Project. And to focus on equitable development east of the Anacostia River. And they presented solutions, you know, to work toward, you know, a collective vision for the development of housing and small business and employment, you know, to address D.C.'s most vulnerable communities. The only problem with that, the registration cost a couple hundred dollars, and, you know, there was none of the most vulnerable people in the room. I was fortunate enough to be there. And it occurred to me that when Alan Novak, one of the city's largest developers, he stood up and said, after like 40 or 50 years of a career of development in the city, he says that developers are social engineers, and they have a responsibility, therefore. And so, with having said that, we're advocating for equitable development. We all know what it is. We've gone from chocolate city to chocolate chip. So if we don't, begin to shape policy, policy will continue to shape us. We all know that urban removal. And so we're trying to change that paradigm by being involved with the process. So this Equitable Economic Development Forum is an Easter River debate with all the Ward 7 and Ward 8 candidates on stage, two separate panels, that is, to challenge them on what their plan to preserve long-time residents and small businesses east of the river. And not only challenge them for their ideas, but to present ours as well. We've been very active, several groups across the city trying to educate the public on what their options are. I had a meeting with a real estate broker who kind of explained the things to me. He said that whenever you hear them say that it's written in stone, it's a done deal, you can't fight City Hall, those are camp games to minimize your resistance. Because in that final analysis, they have to have some level of community support, whether through support or acquiescence, and they really don't care which. Because the ANC commissioners have to sign off on these things, which is why a lot of developers who have projects coming down the pipeline have placed people in these positions so that it is streamlined. So you have three kinds of ANC people. You have those who are put in those positions by developers so that they'd be in their pockets. Or you have those with political ambitions like Fenty and our existing mayor who use that as a trajectory for their political careers and ambition. And then you have third ones that who are actually organic people that come from the community. So I urge your listeners, if they really want to do something, they could right now run almost unopposed in several ANC areas across the city, and that will give us a lot of leverage in these conversations as we move forward to determine what our destiny will look like and what our future will look like. And there's a lot of options that the city has not given to us, and we need to present it to them.
So I, at the top of the show, I use the phrase that I've heard you use a lot, talking about a no displacement zone. And
displacement free zone,
right? So tell me about that in terms of the concerns that people have in Ward 7 and 8 about displacement.
Well, first, displacement free zone event is happening next Tuesday, May 31st from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Arc Theater. That is 1901 Mississippi Avenue, and that's Southern Avenue Metro Station. That's free parking for those who are concerned. You know, we got a lot of Bugetto people that don't want to, that's important to them. But having said that, the slavery-free zone has, one, spurred the legislation already. We are being affected. Councilmember Elisa Silverman and Councilmember LaRubie May, to their credit, have actually sponsored legislation called Displacement Prevention Zone, I believe is the phrase they use. And that was just to offer a buffer for displacement for the oncoming Wizard Stadium in the St. Elizabeth Congress Heights area. And that's a great way to start the conversation. But what we want to see is our definition of displacement, a true displacement free zone, would be a freeze of property taxes. Because we've seen property taxes being used as modern day red line districting. That's how we get people out of their homes, you know, fixed income. That's how we still can change the community. So we wanted to put a cap on that for existing businesses and residences. It's up to debate on what amount of time, 5 years, 7 years, or what have you, that they've already been there, to make sure they get to stay there. And then also guaranteed employment for any jobs that's created in that area. Any jobs that's created in that area, they should have a priority for the people that's in that area, that lives in that neighborhood. We want cops that work work in that neighborhood to live in that neighborhood. That would be an effective community policing. That would be a great panacea for the violence that we see attributed to not just people of color, but poor people in general, by police all over the world. And then finally, we want to see community land trust. For those who are listening in the audience or are not familiar with that, because the government don't want you to be familiar with that. That would empower your community. A community land trust is when the city turns over vacant property to a community group, along with the development money to go with it, to develop property that's not exposed to the ravaging market prices. So that is a true displacement free zone. We can create our own buildings and communities, and we have a rent cap and ownership. So these are things that need to be discussed, because unfortunately, no one's coming to save us. I think with the rise of a black president, and we've seen how much effect that has changed on our everyday lives, so we now know that there's no messiah coming for us, and we must do this work ourselves.
So the Tuesday event at the ARC, that's Tuesday night, and that's 7:30?
That's from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the ARC there.
And that's also going to include the candidates running for office in those wards, right?
Yes, we have Ward 7 and Ward 8 candidates. We have everyone confirmed who's running. The only confirmation I have yet to receive is from Yvette Alexander. So hopefully she will confirm and be there, because Gray has confirmed. And that needs to be, you know, pointed out that we have someone who was, you know, a councilman, council chairman, then mayor, and now he's running again. And he's talking about change. And I'm like, well, he's had plenty of opportunities to invoke that change. So I'm wondering I'm excited to hear what his plans are to address this. I think that, if given the right advocates, presenting a real detailed plan, I think that a lot of these, candidates will actually do the right thing and see the writing on the wall, and recognize that the rules of engagement have to change for East of the River when we talk about equitable economic development.
Okay. Well, I will definitely be there. I want to help with the program on Tuesday night with the, I don't know, what's a debate or forum, but I will definitely be there.
We're like a forum, because we're not really pitting the candidates against each other. It's just a battle of ideas. Who has the best ideas to prevent displacement east of the river and preserve the community and develop the community? We're not trying to defend blight at all. So I encourage your listeners to know that we're crowdsourcing questions. If they want to have their voices heard and quoted from the stage, they can do that by just simply using the hashtag displacement free zone on any relevant social media. We will see that displacement free zone. We will see that. And we look forward to their input and your input as well.
Okay. Well, thank you. I was just speaking to Kamone Freeman, author, activist, you know, radio entrepreneur at WEAC Radio, about the economic forum, the Displacement Free Zone program happening Tuesday night from 6 to 9 p.m. at the ARC in Southeast D.C. And that will have to do it for us on the ground this morning. Thanks again to ER Ship, to Kamone Freeman, to all those who pledged, Michelle Roberts, Hazel in Northeast D.C., Michelle Roberts in D.C. also, and Northwest DC. Please join them, 202-588-9739. We'd like to make our goal this morning. Thanks to Chantel for her reporting at Breaking Through Power, and thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella, and thank you so much for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On The Ground Show. And please support WPFW and keep listener power at Liberation Media on the air, 202-588-9739 or WPFW.org. If you've been thinking about giving but haven't, now's the time. Make sure you indicate that you are calling for On The Ground, and if you're pledging online, that the name of the show On The Ground is in the window of the drop-down menu. Now stay tuned for the local station board show. That's the this week's edition of Community Watch and Comment. And again, the number to call, 202-588-9739, to raise your voice. Peace.